This is Eric Ellefson. Welcome back to the Digital Education Podcast, where I get the opportunity to talk with friends, colleagues, and educators, people in my profession, but people who love my profession as well and love our work that we get to do with kids, get to do in schools. And today I'm with Bill Latham. Bill has been with us in the past before from Meteor Education. He's shared his story in a prior podcast and just kind of where he's gotten to and how he got involved in Meteor Education or how he built Meteor Education with his group and with his colleagues. Bill, but we were at an event with our friend Rex Miller, with your friend in particular that I've gotten to know recently. And we were having a conversation, and really what struck me and really what the focus, I think, hopefully of our time today is, you made the statement of this is a time for either innovation or irrelevance, and it's really the choice of the school leader, the choice of us, the choice of educators. Can you help me like understand more what you're thinking there and why just this stark contrast between innovation and irrelevance?
Yeah, well, Eric, of course, it's always good to have a chance to chat with you. Thank you for the opportunity again. And yeah, the conversation about innovation is, it's rampant. We want to create students, or we want students to come out of school and be innovators. We recognize the need for innovation in most industries. The kind of world that we live in, where whole industries may disappear overnight because of an innovation, really calls on companies to have people that are involved, that are not just creative, but able to collaborate in teams to drive toward innovation. But when we look at schools, the question is, are they really producing innovators, and are they themselves innovative cultures? Because the ancient Greek text that says when the student is fully formed, he will be like his teacher, I think is in play here. We can't imagine that a system is going to consistently produce innovative mindsets when itself needs a tremendous amount of innovation. And so a lot of times when I have opportunity to speak to districts, one of the questions I ask them is there a fate worse than change? And I think there is. I think irrelevance is a fate that's actually worse than change. And this statement really comes, really born, I think, out of the competition that we find very prevalent today in education. You don't think about education necessarily on a first pass as a highly competitive industry. 100 years of a monopoly might be a better way to think about it, where there's always some fringe homeschoolers and some people who might send their children to private school. But the mainstream of American education, even today, is in a traditional public school track. But what's happened really in the last decade has changed the game. I think there's a law of the diffusion of innovation, the idea that when 20% is reached of any particular innovation, that you're at a tipping point and that eventually that innovation takes over. And I think what we've reached is a tipping point in education where we're at a 20% number that might be surprising to people, which is about 1 in 5 students are attending alternatives to traditional public schools today. And of course, that comes in the form of online schools, charter schools, private schools, and even some consumerized learning patterns where I don't necessarily go to just one school. I might get some of my education from the Florida Virtual School. I might get some of my education from a career center that's located in my town. I might go to a traditional school for a couple of my classes. And so when you ask me, what school do you go to? The answer is actually I go to 3 or 4 schools. And I think that's only accelerating as a pattern as we begin to think about both the implications of facilities that are aging and are not really equipped to handle the student populations coming through with the curriculum, and changing consumer patterns of receiving content or instruction from online opportunities or even magnet programs. So this kind of blur is occurring where it's not really just one school I'm going to anymore. And the question is, how does that affect the dollars that are coming into that school or coming into that school district related to educating that student. So every school district is essentially funded by the full-time equivalent model, where if I show up and sit in a seat in your school, there's a certain dollar figure that your district receives to educate. But if I only show up in your school half the time, something happens in the funding model. Or if I choose not to go to your school at all, something else happens in the funding model, which may be that I don't have funding at all for that student, even though their presence is in my geography. And so that competitive drive for who gets the dollars and who's deciding who gets the dollars, today students and their parents are in a better position, maybe more than they have been in 100 years, to make a decision like that. So the irrelevance conversation is, someone will educate children in the community. And the question is, will it be you or will it be somebody else?
This is great, because it hits on so many points. And I had a meeting with a student today that is going to our school, going part-time to another school, and then taking online classes. So it's this great example of, you know, I love, you know, school, but I love my school, and in the conversation of, well, what is my school? You know, in our community, and the connectivity between these different schools in our community. Here's my question, maybe, you know, as we look at it, nobody wants to live in irrelevance. I mean, I think sometimes we pigeonhole ourselves there, or we move there. Maybe for the question, especially for people who listen to this, how do we just push innovation? How do we just keep pushing on this, where you're saying this tipping point? And how do we kind of keep it pushing and moving forward so that we can see more significant change and really even kind of, you know, push some of the irrelevance out of the marketplace even?
Well, so here's what's funny. Innovation by itself is a moral neutral word. I mean, we innovated nuclear weapons many years ago, and I think there'd be a lot of people that would say that particular innovation may or may not have been overly good. So I think there's productive or positive innovation, and I think there's innovation that takes us in a different kind of direction. There's innovation that could dehumanize. I mean, a lot of the technologies that have come into consumer markets, into healthcare, into education, et cetera, they can actually dehumanize a person, or it's an innovation, but it's not something that's beneficial in the larger sense of how we're trying to benefit students from an educational perspective. So there, I think the innovation question is, how do you engage today's students? And when I say students are engaged, I mean, I'm emotionally connected to the material. I am socially connected in the group that I'm a part of. I have the right tools to do the things you're asking me to do. And ultimately, that I'm willing to risk and engage in more cognitively demanding tasks and in rigor, such that I'm going to benefit or scaffold my knowledge up from where I'm at today. So the student engagement question is really the question of innovation. How do you innovate or drive forward on positive student engagement? And that's really, I think, where districts are struggling, where school systems are struggling to really get at. When you ask superintendents the question, what's top of mind? Number one concern you have as a superintendent, in a national Gallup survey, they'll tell you it's graduation rate. And number two is student engagement. And it turns out those two things are just two sides of the exact same coin. If I stay engaged in my educational process, there's a good chance I'm going to get through my educational process. And so one of those is what I might even call a lag measure. It's getting up and reading something in the paper that happened yesterday. I'm interested in it. It's important about what the quarterly earnings of the company that I just invested in were. But the real question is, on a forward-looking basis, what are the things I could look at, like engagement, that would predict or be a leading indicator of the lag measures that I seek? And so I think the question we should be asking is, how do we innovate in this area of student engagement, given the realities of the student populations that are coming into our schools today, the ways that they tend to want to engage and learn? And then am I willing to make the dedicated shift to do education that way? I think that's the question that's facing really the districts.
So you run a number of schools. I mean, your programs and your development. And so in this, you know, and then even spend a little bit of time with you this summer and watching some of the work that you're doing, like, what are the ways that your school, Meteor Education, and your schools and your leaders are in a sense pushing this idea of positive student engagement, or develop, and maybe not pushing, it's not the right word, but developing it, cultivating it, creating a community where, you know, adults and students are engaged in this process together?
Well, the first thing is there's a basic presupposition that the idea of education is not a transaction, therefore it's not a program. Education, by its very definition, is permissive in nature. I have to allow you to influence me, and therefore I have to have a relationship with you. And so in everything we do, in our conversations with people, it's about how does your work humanize what has become a machine? And when you think about student engagement, the real aha moment is that teacher engagement is actually the leading indicator of student engagement. So it's really not even a conversation. Every lag measure has some leading indicator. Well, the leading indicator of student engagement is teacher engagement. And when we look at the numbers generally in the population at large, right now, 1 in 3 teachers nationally reports themselves to be actively engaged in their work. And about 6 in 10 would report themselves to be passively disengaged, with about 1 in 10 reporting themselves ready to leave the profession today. And when we, well, let's just get the teachers engaged. What's the challenge of teacher engagement or teacher disengagement? Because a lot of times it's not a question of teachers that don't care. It turns out that the engagement issue with teachers oftentimes is found around an issue of teacher demoralization or teacher burnout. And those are issues of teachers caring so much that they're giving out of their essence and not out of their overflow. And so before you can get into what are we going to do to innovate our education, we've got to have a population of people that are ready to innovate, that want to innovate, that have the bandwidth, the kind of the internal bandwidth to innovate. We go to teachers all the time. Here's the new program. Here's the new program. Here's the new technology. And initiative fatigue is rampant with teachers because we don't see districts and clients that are willing to just stick with something that is fundamentally what they believe about education and to see it through. And so I don't believe this is going to stay around. And I've tried it 3 or 4 times and I'm tired. I'm tired of the change. I'm tired of not being trained and deployed. And so we run into a lot of issues that are burnout and demoralization that are not about disengagement, but they look like disengagement. And the big challenge is disengagement looks like I don't like you to a child. I think there's a fatal assumption that a lot of people make, which is, well, the relationships between teachers and students are ultimately very good. And it's all these other factors. But if you ask, actually get into asking students a lot of times, I think it was LA Unified School District had a survey that noted that 70% of their middle schoolers reported that they believed at least one of their teachers, quote unquote, hates them. Now, we know that their teachers don't hate them, but disengagement or burnout or demoralization begins to look to a child like, I don't like you. And I think that's where we see the breakdown here of all of the programs and innovative change that we want to enact is right at that classroom level where the teacher is the thermostat of culture and the thermostat of innovation, right? They're going to determine the temperature and how quickly or slowly an innovation may come. And so that's a real topic of conversation right now that I think that we have to engage. Learning cultures and innovative cultures are cultures where people are ready and able and have the overflow to move forward with innovation. And that's not the current state of most people, most schools that we interact with.
And so, you know, as you interact with schools and as you, you know, work with them and as you work with teachers, like what are some of the, and I know it's a culture thing, right? So you can do these things, but you don't necessarily build the culture. What are the cultures or where are the places or what are the things that you see when, you know what, hey, this place is doing it well, where they value their teachers, they train their teachers, they create a culture of appreciation. You know, they're not extending these professionals beyond those limits so that they are, you know, working and serving and living out of the overflow and out of the abundance rather than out of, you know, the lack of margin. And so what are the some of the practical applications where you're seeing it done well?
So the first thing, believe it or not, everything rises and falls on leadership inside of a school. The number one stressor for teachers, as it turns out, is a lack of strong principal leadership or stable principal leadership. The average turnover of principals in the United States is every 3 years. So we have 100% turnover of our principals on average every 3 years in education. Now, a company trying to sustain the turnover of their CEO once every 3 years is a company in trouble. Anybody in the business community would tell you that. But we kind of pass over that in education. And in fact, there are some districts who believe strongly in switching their principals around every few years just so they don't get too cozy with the staff, or because it allows for some variety, if you will, in how schools are led. And it turns out, I think that's a terrible strategy. I think that it's borne out in that being such a stress factor. Every new leader that comes in has got some kind of difference that they end up bringing into a school. And a lot of times that means we're picking up something and putting something else down that we just started to get comfortable with. And so what we see in successful schools is schools that have committed to principal leadership and developing leaders at the principal level and leaving them in place as they develop their initiatives. And that leads to the second big stressor, which is a lack of a strong collegial environment with teachers, where the teachers are in a very collegial, tight working relationship. There's research that was done by John Hattie where he did meta-analysis, and in his meta-analysis where he's looking at the most effective influences of student progress in school, the number two influence that had been looked at in over 1,500 education studies is the collective teacher efficacy. And that's teachers that are working well together around common goals and in a collegial and effective environment. And so you can see how leadership and consistency of leadership ties directly to the stability that's needed to develop those long-term work teams around an idea, or what we might even call a learning framework, a framework of beliefs that lead to instructional practice, that lead to how we organize our technology and our spaces and our curriculum to build an ecosystem that supports something that's our vision for these students. Those are two of the biggest things that we find. And then I think the other piece of it is we find that the lack of autonomy in the teacher's world is a really difficult hurdle to try to figure out, because what ends up happening is, in jobs where you have high cognitive demand, but also high autonomy. So you take professional CEOs, principals of firms, et cetera, they have high cognitive stress and as a part of their normal work, but they also have a high autonomy in dealing with both the stress and the work resources that are necessary to deal with those stressors. When you look at in the same kinds of vein, people that have high cognitive demand with very low autonomy, you find that these are some of the most sick and depressed and as a group unhealthy people on the planet. I mean, take call centers where somebody is calling you and they're unhappy and you can only give them three answers and none of the three are going to make them happy and you only have a minute and a half to get them off the phone. They've done studies to show just how unhealthy it is to be in a call center long-term. And it's the effects of cortisol and long-term stress and chronic disease that creep into those scenarios. And it's what we're finding in our teaching population. We're finding that the low autonomy, I'm going to not only tell you what to do, I'm going to tell you how to do it, and without the resources, and you cannot bring your own creativity to the equation. So those are really big stressors that exist. And Penn State has a very good white paper that really outlines the major stressors for teachers. And if there was a last component, it's just somebody's ability to recognize their own social and emotional trauma or the social and emotional drain of environments like this, and to rest and recharge properly. And so a lot of teachers I know, they love their students so much, they love the profession so much, they will knowingly let the profession take them over. And then one day it snaps. And that day it snaps, there's no recovery. They're not coming back from it. And we could have avoided that if we had just given them, more permission to take care of themselves. It's the classic caregiver's dilemma.
So Bill, as you get excited about this and as you get excited about the change and as you see such a large picture of this as you travel the country and interact with so many different people across the education world and even the business world, what do you see going forward, or what would be, you know, kind of the innovation, you know, kind of that innovation idea, but what do you see going forward that as a collective group of educators around the country or even around the world, where we can just kind of keep pushing this work, you know, that collective nature of teacher efficacy, the taking care of each other, the building up of our profession, the working together, the autonomy. Like, what do you see out there that can drive us, or how can we drive together towards, you know, that better schools and a better profession?
So the way that we currently measure, there's an old adage, that which gets measured gets done. So a lot of the measures that we find in education now, they're lag indicators. How did that school do on its standardized test in March and we find out in July? And what percentage of kids graduated, in May, and we find out, you know, at the end of a school year, what that looks like? These again, this is reading in the newspaper, and it's one of the reasons why the system is so slow in responding. We're not in the business of finding out if our teachers are really engaged and what we need to do to improve local learning cultures. The funny thing is, depending on the community that you're in, depending on the student population that you have, one of the things in the book, Humanizing the Education Machine, we notice not all schools are created equally. There are schools that are literally what we deemed in the taxonomy left behind schools. And these are schools that are custodial in nature. They have children that come from low socioeconomic backgrounds. School safety, not just at school, but walking to and from school, safe transport, living in neighborhoods where violence, kids are dealing with significant adverse childhood experiences. The strategies in a school like that for how do we make sure the teachers are ready to do the work is different, because those teachers are dealing with secondary trauma every day. My trauma is becoming your trauma. And if I have 30 children and I care at all about them, the secondary trauma build on me is significant. And we don't equip teachers particularly well to deal in the area of secondary trauma and how to manage in that situation. So in that school, we might find it's more important that the teachers are dealing with the secondary trauma that's in their world as a result of being the primary caregivers during the day to those children of trauma. And that might be very different. That might be what I call the enemy from without, where the community around us is a bit of a war zone. And that war zone finds its way into the trauma of the children that we are then trying to serve as an educator. But then you have the enemy within. And when you move the taxonomy and you say there's a big pile of schools that we found in a category we might call well-schooled and poorly educated. And these are schools where the kids do well on standardized tests and they graduate in high rates and they walk into college or career and they fail miserably because they lack the soft skills to really accelerate. But in those schools, what's prized is the grade, the outcome. The journey is not the thing, it's the outcome. And there's high pressure from within, whether it's within the school leadership or whether it's the parents within the school who are... I get that my kid should be able to collaborate, but really, what's his grade? That's more important to me that he get into college. Well, he's not going to succeed in college or ultimately in life if he hasn't picked up the soft skills that he needs. And this is really the area of a well-schooled, poorly educated school and why we deemed it as such. Well, you can imagine the strategy is very different there, because it turns out that the pressure point on the teacher might not be the secondary trauma of the child. It's the trauma created in trying to deal with a world where I see these kids are not going to be successful, but the pressure that's put on me against metrics that are not really helpful creates cognitive dissonance with me, and it kind of sucks the life out of you. I'm reminded, I think we're in the 30th year anniversary of The Princess Bride, and in that movie, they hook up Wesley to the machine, and they turn the machine on and suck 1 year of his life away, and I honestly believe that in that kind of school, teaching can become a yearly life-sucking activity where I've just sucked 1 year of your life away. And of course, we all remember his response to having your life sucked away. He just kind of whimpers at the end of it. So I think depending on where the school is in terms of its student population, the community around it, is the enemy from without or within, or in, you know, some horrible instances, it's both the community from without and it's the pressures from within. And we find that a lot. And I think it's instructive that, was it this week, the cover of Time. And we've got this very topic on the cover of Time now, which means someone is starting to pay attention in the mainstream to this is our issue. And if we don't win the battle here, if you are not committed to winning the battle there as a learning culture, this is where I think you'll become irrelevant. Somebody will come along and recruit that teacher away from you. Somebody will choose to take their child and put them somewhere else in a school that doesn't have that kind of culture. And eventually you will have permission taken from you to educate and hand it to someone else in your community.
Bill, I'm going to end there because, I mean, I think that's perfect. And it gives us a place that for the future, maybe possibly having you back to kind of follow up on some of that stuff, you know, a few months down the road or something on that order, because I think, you know, that Time Magazine, you know, issue and some of that conversation, and had that conversation recently with another friend, is such a big deal because it is that question of, okay, what are we doing? What are we going to be about as a profession? But what is the collective support for even our profession and the work that we get to do? So for the next conversation, Bill, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Eric. Thank you.
All right, buddy. Appreciate your time.
Yes, sir. Well, you have a wonderful